Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Hey everybody, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you so very much for taking the time to listen. I do appreciate you. As always, feel free to reach out to us in the Discord room. If you go to Beekeeping for Newbies, that's newbees.com. About halfway down the left, we've got a link, and we've also got the link included all over the place in video descriptions and other places. So feel free to join us there and chat about all things bee-related. So I wanted to start off first thing today, something that's been on my mind for a while, and I want to make sure everybody knows about it. We've got an 8-year-old young man named Nash down in Texas. We have recently welcomed him into the first Sting Club. It's my understanding that he took the sting like a champ, so congrats, Nash. I hope you and your folks and your granddad are doing well down there and that y'all have a great bee season this year. Okay, so today we've got a pretty exciting interview. I know I mentioned it in the Discord room before. I didn't give you a lot of details because I wanted it to be a surprise, but we're going to jump right into that now. So without further ado, I want to introduce you to Dr. Ozturk from the University of Texas, San Antonio. Dr. Ozturk, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to kind of, level set things for everyone. And you know, we've got a lot of things that are not the normal topics that we cover here on the podcast. A lot of the discussions that we have tend to be around, how do you grow your apiary? How do you feed? How do you care for, you know, the ins and outs and the day-to-day activities taking place as a beekeeper? But the activities that you're involved in are a little bit different, but absolutely related. But before we kind of jump in, if you wouldn't mind telling us just a little bit about yourself and, you know, your background, anything that you'd like to share with the listeners, that'd be great.
Yeah, that would be great. So I'll be just introduce myself. So, I'm originally from Turkey, and I was born and raised in Turkey. I completed my college in Istanbul in biology, then I moved to the University of Nevada, Reno for my PhD back in 2003. So that I did my PhD in cell and molecular biology. I focused on gene therapy. And then I had my postdoc at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, and I worked on cell signaling and bioinformatics. And then I returned to my home country, and I served as department chair for cell and molecular biology and genetics department. And then at that time, I was also the director of Honey Research Center, and one and unique center in Turkey that we focused on analyzing the honeys from different parts of Turkey. And then I came to the United States again, and I worked at Alma College, Michigan for 1 year in the biochemistry department, and I taught medicinal properties of honey as a class for the first time there. And then I moved to San Antonio in 2018, and I worked as a high school teacher for 3.5 years, and then I joined University of Texas San Antonio, UTSA, during the COVID time, actually, just ending of the COVID time, and in the biosciences department. And currently, I'm an assistant professor of practice, and I'm teaching medicinal properties of honey as a undergraduate research-based course, and I'm also teaching biosciences here.
Okay, well, that's a pretty extensive background, so I think you're definitely the right guy to talk about some of the things that we're talking about today, specifically as it relates to medicinal honey and some of the benefits, you know, around it. You know, I think that everybody who is either involved in beekeeping
or whether you are or not, really. I mean, if you're a beekeeper, I would say probably 75 to 80% of people who are interested in starting to get into the hobby, one of the first questions is how long before I get honey, right? So everybody always thinks about, about, you know, getting that sweet nectar and, you know, being able to put it into their drinks and their foods and other things. But I believe that one area I think that is really, really highly underrepresented in modern medicine is the medicinal use of honey. I mean, I feel like, you know, this is a topic we could probably have a 2-hour long discussion on by itself, but you know, from your perspective, and obviously, like, you know, you're in the trenches with this every day. You know, what are some of the, I would say, facts and key points in this space that you think people should really be paying attention to? Like, for example, you know, as we started our discussion, understanding, you know, medicinal properties of, but then being cognizant of medical grade honey. You know, I've never heard of that. I don't really know the difference, but you know, could you shed some light on some of the things that people really ought to be paying attention to in that area?
Sure. I mean, definitely, I would maybe start with a little bit of historical background. So I think most of us know that honey has been a medicine by our parents, by our grandparents. But historically, almost every civilization on Earth, they have used honey as a medical device or a medical tool. So honey has been a therapeutic agent more than as a food throughout the history, like the Romans, Greeks, Chinese, Persians, Turks, Arabs. I mean, all of the civilization on Earth, they have used honey to prepare different type of recipes or prescriptions to use honey in them. Like, for example, Hippocrates, Galen, Avicenna, these are the top three people of the medicine, and then they have used honey in several of their prescriptions. And, for example, in the Egyptian papyri, there are more than 500 papyri that contains honey to prepare different type of ointments or for different ailments, they have used those. So, and even, you know, honey was found in one of the tombs of Tutankhamun, which is about 3,000 years old. So it was that much revered. So from this perspective, honey is being with us as a medicine for thousands of years. By the advent of antibiotics and other medications in the Western medicine, so honey has been put aside with the other traditional medicine products. So like since about almost 100 years, honey was underrepresented or understudied. But 1990s, Professor Peter Molin from New Zealand, he started working on medicinal honey from the Manuka honey, early 1990s. And then also there are some professors from UK, Dr. Zumla, for example, they studied about how honey can be a medicine, especially from the antibacterial properties. So these studies started coming out and out, and as the millennium started, I mean, past the 2000, so the number of research about analyzing honey for medicinal properties has increased. But unfortunately, or I would say, like, most of these studies are coming from countries other than United States, right? Most of them come from Australia, New Zealand, Malaysia, Balkans in Europe, and Middle Eastern countries, and you know, some African countries. So there are, and also some Latin countries as well, South American ones. So, but very few of these research coming from the United States. So it is a kind of underrepresented territory or uncharted territory for the scientists in the U.S. to understand better, like, how honey can be a medicine. And then as we understood more and more, so we started to decipher the properties of honey, and then we started to classify them based on their antimicrobial and antioxidant properties, and as well as physicochemical characteristics. So then some of the honeys have more potential than compared to other ones, and they were named or classified as medical grade honey. And probably you, most of the beekeepers know, or people who are involved in honey, they know the Manuka honey. So Manuka honey was, again, kind of discovered and promoted and researched and marketed by Professor Peter Molin of New Zealand, who is a microbiologist per profession. And then New Zealand is the country that has like embraced the Manuka as their national product, and they established their own methodology to identify different Manuka honeys in terms of unique Manuka factor or methylglyoxal content, which is accumulating in them, or also some other K factors or so. So now, right now in the market, most of the medical grade honeys available is the Manuka honey. But on the other hand, we have lots of other resources, because again, monarch honey is out there for almost like 30 years. But before that, honey was out there. Different countries were using honey, different civilizations using honey with different properties. So what we are trying to do is, as a scientist, we are trying to identify local resources if they have the medical grade potential. So if they become, if they can be used for different diseases. Do you want me to talk about more about the diseases that honey is being used?
Oh, I'd love to hear more. Absolutely.
Sure. Okay, so honey was number one wound healing agent in almost all the civilizations that was used. You know, people used to have battles and then they got wounded. So after the wound bleeding is done, so then the first thing they put is their honey with some dressing. And then honey is helping wound healing from three different levels. So normally in wound healing, they have four steps. One is bleeding and the other one is inflammation and infection. Third one is proliferation of the cells. And fourth one is remodeling, which is the scar tissue as removing of that one. So honey can help all last three steps of the wound healing. Honey doesn't stop bleeding, but as soon as bleeding is done, so honey can help with the regulation of the inflammation of the tissue, which is wounded. And then honey can also help with the infection, because honey is an antimicrobial agent, and it has been shown that honey can kill more than 600 different bacteria in vitro analysis and as well as from the wound clinical trials. And honey also has been shown to kill resistant bacteria like methicillin-resistant Staph aureus or vancomycin-resistant bacteria. So honey has been a very strong antimicrobial agent. And interestingly enough, most of the antibiotics are losing their effectiveness after the bacteria grown resistant to them. So antimicrobial resistance has become one of the major world health problems. And eventually, it will be the number one killer in the world by 2050. It is expected to kill more than 10 million people per year because of this resistant bacteria. But interestingly enough, there is no resistance has been recorded for honey yet. So that's why honey is a very strong antibacterial agent with high potential to be used in the medical field. So in addition to this one, like controlling the infection there or diminishing the infection, honey also helps with the proliferation of the, you know, all the epithelial cells or fibroblasts, which are important for the wound healing. And finally, honey has been shown to remove the scar tissue or like remodel the tissue without leaving any scar tissue there. So when the wounds are treated with honey, no scar tissue is left behind. And we can tell about this, like in some countries, they use honey for C-section. So after they, the doctors do the last of their stitches, they put honey into the C-section area to prevent inflammation and as well as to prevent infection of the bacteria. And as a result, they also have no scar tissue left. I know plastic surgeons are not like this, but honey kind of leaves the scar tissue, leaves the wound without any scar tissue most of the time. So in addition, honey has been used for gastrointestinal diseases such as diarrhea and constipation, so which are opposed of each other, but honey can help each other, both of them, just by the temperature. So somebody who has constipation, they should use warm honey drink. So by this way, they will soften the tissue, to soften the stool, and then also activate the bacteria, which are good for our health, and then our gut microbiome. So honey can loosen the stool through the bacteria and through the heat. For the diarrhea, the patients, they should use cold honey drink, because cold honey drink provides less peroxide activity, and then again it will regulate and it will increase the holding of the water in the bowels. So by this way, honey can prevent or decrease the diarrhea as well. So, but don't confuse them; it will get worse. So we should be careful about warm drink versus the cold drink. Again, honey has been used for some eye diseases like conjunctivitis, pink eye disease. Honey is being used for several different skin diseases like acne or even for psoriasis and other diseases. Honey has been used as a spermicide, by the way. I mean, it's being used for birth control because of this acidity when honey is placed into the birth area. So it will kill the sperms because of its acidic properties. So by this way, it's used as a birth control mechanism. Again, honey has been used for some treatment of some neurological disorders such as anxiety and then also some depression. But again, there are not so many studies supporting this. It is just historical data. So, and I think these are pretty much it about how we can use honey for various diseases.
Hey, everyone, thank you for listening. I hope that you're enjoying the show and are finding the information to be useful and valuable. In order to help keep the lights on, we do need to take a quick commercial break. Thank you so very much for hanging in there, and I appreciate you. We will be right back. When I was little, my grandmother had bird feeders and a bird bath in her backyard. Some of my favorite memories growing up were listening to her tell me everything she knew about the feathered friends that visited her yard daily. How amazing would it have been for us to be able to capture images and videos of that experience and to be able to share them with others? Well, if you're ready to take your backyard bird watching to the next level, FeatherSnap makes Wi-Fi-enabled smart bird feeders that blend the best of technology and nature. Get a high-def glimpse of your feathered friends with a top-of-the-line camera so every visitor can be seen with clarity and detail. A unique dual-feeder bin helps attract more species, and built-in solar panels keep your camera's battery going strong. FeatherSnap's mobile app creates a truly immersive experience, allowing you to collect and organize your favorite pics and videos and earn badges along the way. Best of all, FeatherSnap offers expert-trained AI identification of more than 275 North American species thanks to their in-house ornithologist. Check them out today at feathersnapcam.com. That's feathersnapcam.com. As most of you know, I'm a big fan of the outdoors, and most of my time is dedicated to beekeeping and gardening-related discussions. But you probably did not know that one of my responsibilities as a kid was caring for our houseplants. Yes, part of my $5 a week allowance went towards making sure all of the houseplants were healthy and happy. We used to have shamrocks, Christmas cactus, philodendron, and more. Which leads us to today's podcast sponsor, and a special thanks to Palm Street. Palm Street is the best live shopping app for the plant lover community. You can buy and sell rare plants, crystals, ceramics, and other unique goods. Connect with trusted plant sellers and nurseries that sell nationwide. Shop 24/7 and with live human customer support. What I love most about Palm Street is joining a live stream where sellers walk through all the details and characteristics of the plants they're offering. You can get live answers to your questions and see what questions others have asked as well. It's such a great way to engage for buyers and sellers. And as a special offer, new users will receive $5 app credit, 10% off their first order, and up to $6 off shipping for 3 orders. Palm Street, available on Google Play or the App Store.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of 5-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
All right, everyone, welcome back, and thank you for staying with us today. As always, feel free to reach out if you have any questions or comments. I always enjoy hearing about your experiences, answering questions, and learning more about the challenges you're facing in different parts of the world, so please keep them coming. Now let's get back to the show on the Beekeeping for Newbies radio network. Okay, that's not a real thing, but I'm trying to make it sound more official, so just play along, all right? Thanks a lot.
Well, that's quite a bit. I mean, as you're talking in my mind, my mind just kept going in all these different directions because, you know, like one of the things I thought about was a couple of examples. I think I remember reading a long time ago that inside the pyramids, and you're probably going to know about this, but that there was actual honey found inside the pyramids, if I'm correct.
Yes, that's what I mentioned, actually. In the Egyptian, so in the Tutankhamun's pyramid, they found a honey sample or honey in a pot, which is 3,000 years old and still edible.
So that leads into another question that I've had people ask. You know, I've had people say, oh, well, you know, for example, if they buy it from the store and it has a, you know, best buy this date. And I said, well, hold on. No, that's honey. Like, it never goes bad. You may have to heat it up and, you know, if it gets a little bit crystallized or anything. But you know, as you went through all the different things, I think, you know, two or three of them, I thought, oh, okay, yeah, I've heard about that before. But
the majority of what you were talking about is new to me. So that's really fascinating when it gets to the scarring and, of course, the drug resistance. I mean, that's a huge, huge thing as it relates to bacterial resistance and yep. as you touched on. And I think that that's really fascinating. I was reading some of the research I think that, you know, your students had done and trying to determine the amount of bacteria that the varying types of honey could address or could, I don't know what the right word is.
Inhibit.
Okay, inhibit, absolutely. So that kind of leads into, you know, another question. Are you finding in your research certain areas or regions or certain types of honeybees that are producing honey that tends to be more effective or less effective, or is it kind of hitting a moving target just because of all the variables involved?
Yes, I mean, honey medicinal property is coming from different resources. I mean, the most important part is the flora, like where the honeybees are getting their nectar. So as you know, honeybees can get their nectar from the blooms, flower blooms, and as well as from the honeydew, which is the secretions or excretions of the aphids or secretions of the plant. So most of the time, honeydew honeys, they are darker in color because it's coming directly from the plant or directly from the another insect, such as the aphids or lanternflies. And then those will be have darker, and most of the time they have more antioxidants in them, such as the polyphenols or flavonoids or tannins. So these are the ones that are contributing to the antioxidant properties of the honey. And antioxidant properties are very important for the regulation of the inflammation and as the proliferation phase of the wound healing. But on the other hand, antimicrobial properties, these are also coming from different sources. Again, these are coming from organic compounds inside the plant. And they also come from the enzymes that are coming directly from the bee. So that's why not every honey is created equal. So every honey has its own properties for antioxidant and antimicrobial properties. And this needs to be analyzed in the lab setting. There's no way to analyze them in your home. So we use some like microbiology techniques and as well as some antioxidants, like some biochemistry chemicals that we use to identify them. And we are using about 10 different measurements to identify the medical grade honey in our lab. So and then all these are combined and we've generated a formula to find out what is the bioactivity level. In short, it's called BAL, B-A-L. So every honey has a BAL value, and this BAL value is kind of identifying their medical grade potential. So, and yes, there are different honeys in the world. As I mentioned, Manuka is number one or most well-known, but there are other honeys which are more potent than Manuka honey, more antimicrobial or more antioxidant. So Manuka honey is more antimicrobial, but it doesn't have so much antioxidant properties. So, and then again, Manuka honey is its own disadvantage of like when you consume Manuka honey too much, it can cause cytotoxicity, so it can kind of kill human cells. It can cause some disease if it is consumed too much early. That's why medical-grade Manuka honey is only consumed topically, like on the wounds. But the Manuka honey available on the stores, they are intermediate-level Manuka honey. They are not high-level Manuka honey because there are five different levels of Manuka, and the ones on the stores are the level 3 and low, like level 2, level 3, and level 1. But the ones that are available in the medical market, they are level 4 and 5. And lay people can very hardly to buy those 4 and 5. They're only available for the medical suppliers. So in addition to this one, like, for example, Tualang honey from Malaysia or Gela honey from Malaysia, which are the cousins of Manuka honey, but they are also so much used in the clinical trials. And there are thousands of people treated in Indonesia and Malaysia by using these honey types. In addition, there is also, for example, from Turkey, my home country, we have chestnut honey, and we have oak honey, which is also available in the Balkans. So these honeys are, again, very high antimicrobial and antioxidant properties. And we have cedar honey from Middle Eastern regions. And again, cedar honey is a very famous one that is historically used for hundreds of years for medical treatment. And then in U.S., actually, there's a honey recently discovered, which is called spotted lanternfly honey. So this is a honeydew honey, and spotted lanternfly is considered as an invasive species in the U.S. So, I mean, the entomologists or, you know, pest controls, they are trying to stop the growth of invasion of the lanternfly. But on the other hand, honeybees, they have a mutual relationship with them, that they collect the feces or excretions for the lanternflies, which are feeding on the sap of the trees, and they cannot consume all the sugar that they get, and they excrete them, and we collect these excretions and make honey out of those. So SLF honey has also been shown to be very high antimicrobial and high antioxidant as well, which is a very strong candidate from the U.S. to become a medical-grade honey. And again, in my region in San Antonio, we found out the oak honey from Hill Country region, like from north of San Antonio and also south of Austin area. So this oak honey has been become a very strong candidate in terms of antimicrobial and antioxidant properties. And we are analyzing more than 250 samples, and we are still kind of putting them in an order, like in terms of their bioactivity levels. And some regions, especially less flowers, more tree regions, like more forested regions, they are having more antioxidant property or more medical-grade honey is what we have analyzed so far. But again, it's not the final analysis. We are still working on them with my students. And another example is from Latin America. We have the ulmo honey from Chile. Again, it has been studied to a large extent. And I think these are the ones that in addition, there's one honey which is kind of interesting, which is med honey. So med honey is also known as psychedelic honey. And because of, med honey causes some, it causes bradycardia, which is slowing down the heart rate and also lowering the blood pressure. But if it's consumed too much, it can cause convulsions and even death. I mean, it may end up in the ER. So even now, people in different parts of the world, like Northeast Turkey or in Nepal or Himalaya, they are harvesting med honey from rhododendron, and it causes some major problems. But on the other hand, med honey is the first bioweapon used in the history, because med honey was used to kind of cause hallucinations in the Roman soldiers by the Persian soldiers, as they agreed with the villagers, and they put honey pots filled with med honey on the route of the Roman soldiers. And then when the Roman soldiers saw the honey pots, they indulged in them. They liked it a lot, and then they just eat a lot of almost all of them, and then they got convulsions. And the Persian soldiers came and chopped off their heads, and they won the whole battle.
Oh, wow.
So again, it's a little bit risky. So there's toxic honey available in different parts.
I feel like I've failed myself and my listeners here, because about 90% of everything you said is brand new to me, and I've never heard this before, and I feel like I haven't done my due diligence, so I appreciate all the detail there. There's probably five or six things that I'd love to dive into for another half hour each, but maybe we'll revisit that. But well, so one question that comes to mind for me, and I'm sure that a lot of kind of regular folks are going to want to ask and would think about, if we're talking about, we recognize that we both have topical as well as internal, benefits of honey. If I'm just a regular person living in a city, no access to anything that would be organic or anything, I'm going to the grocery store. It's a two-part question. Question part one would be, is there any benefit at all that we're going to get if you're buying something from your standard grocery store, whether it's topical or ingested? And then question two being, if you go to maybe a local farmer's market and you're buying something that was produced locally, can we maybe get some elevated benefit from that? Probably not quite as good as the medical grade, but are we getting some level of benefit from those that might be purchased from a local apiary or farm?
Oh, sure. That's a very good question, actually. As I mentioned about bioactivity levels, so BAL is, every honey has a BAL value. I mean, whenever we analyze the honey, they all have low or high BAL values. Like we, for example, last year, we analyzed 120 samples, I think, or 150 samples. So we found out, like, the BAL level can be as low as 17, or it can go above 100. So based on these 10 different measurements that we are using. So and we also did a very recent study, but we compared the grocery store honeys with the local beekeeper honeys. I'm not talking about farmer market honeys. I'm talking about the honeys that are collected directly from the beekeepers. Because my farmer's market is also open for, I don't want to use a negative word, but it's also open for blending. So, because I heard some stories that some of the farmer market honey sellers, they use some other honeys as they blend with their own honeys to earn more. So, grocery store honeys, again, most of the honey in the U.S. is imported. Because all the honeybees, all the colonies available in the U.S., we can only produce 20% of our honey consumption. So 80% of our honey is coming from out of country. Like they are coming from Argentina, from Ukraine, from India, Vietnam. They are coming all over the world. And they are blended with U.S. honey most of the time. So it is very hard to find out like their values unless you know which exact location is coming from. So that's why grocery store honey is not my first stop to buy the honey, especially if I'm interested in medical value. But what we analyze is that like about from the grocery store honey is up to 12% of them, like we analyzed 40 honey, so up to 12% of them, they have antimicrobial properties. But again, we got the honey from HEB in San Antonio, Walmart, and then Trader Joe's, the Whole Food Market. So we collected honey samples from these, but again, I cannot give the name of the or properties of them. But again, we found only 12% of them, which means the 4 or 5 of them, they have antibacterial properties. So they have like they can kill the Staph aureus. But then we analyzed the local honeys from the local beekeepers. We found out about 60 to 70% of the local honey, they have antimicrobial properties. So this is a very significant difference. So the other thing is that when I buy honey from, it's like when my friends ask me which honey I should buy if I need to buy from a store, I always tell them, I mean, try to buy the darker color honey, because the darker the color of honey, the higher antioxidant potential has been observed. So there's a correlation between the honey color and antioxidant properties. But for antimicrobial, there is not a correlation we found yet with the color and antimicrobial properties. So again, in short, if you need to buy honey either from farmer's market or from grocery store, I would recommend buying the darker color honey, such as amber, dark amber, or even light amber is also fine, but not the water white honeys or not like very light color honeys.
Sure, okay.
Because they do not progress so much of bioactivity level.
No, that makes sense. You know, as you were talking, I was reminded, and this is probably just a good, you know, general PSA for anybody listening, but I was watching probably a year or so ago on Netflix a series called Rotten, R-O-T-T-E-N, and I think it was season 1, episode 1, talking about honey and everything that goes into the importation of the honey here in the U.S., but not just the importation, because there's a lot of countries, as you know, sir, that are banned. We will not import from these countries. And what they do is they'll take their honey and then they mix it with a lot of high fructose corn syrup. And then they send it over to another country, and then that country puts it in their barrels that is not, they're not restricted from us. And then we have the ability, and this is probably something that I would bet that you've done or your students have been involved in, where they're actually testing it down like at the cellular, molecular kind of level, and they're able to identify, no, there's pollen in here that's native only to China or only to these certain places. And it was incredibly fascinating. I think they were using some, I almost want to say it was like nuclear level technology, but whatever it was incredibly fascinating. So if anybody has it.
They use nuclear magnetic resonance, so NMR technology in Germany.
Okay, yeah, so if anybody has a chance to watch that, I highly encourage them, because it was incredibly fascinating about everything that we go through to try and stop the adulteration of the honey and all of that. So that's very interesting. That's kind of a thought that spurred as you were talking. So I'm going to segue to something that's coming up in the near future here. On April 8th, we've got a bit of an event taking place in North America here in the U.S., and I know, you know, one of the activities that you folks have going on down there at UT San Antonio is related to this. If you wouldn't mind taking a few minutes and let us know what you have going on.
Yes, I mean, it's a very interesting thing that we are doing here. So as I was discussing, one of the physics professor that she is my co-PI for a grant that we have been awarded. So she mentioned about like, oh, there are two eclipses coming into the United States. So this year, one is the annular, the other one is total. So she asked me, like, I mean, what did you look for? Like, what do the bees do during this time? I mean, how do the bees behave during the eclipse? And I said, wow, that's a great question. So let's dive in and find out how much research has been done. So I found out, like, there are only 2 or 3 researches or scientific studies has been done during the eclipse, either annular or total eclipses. So one of them was in 2017, and the other one was on the news, actually, very famously. I forgot, I think from a professor from Mississippi or Missouri. So So she has done a research with the school students. So they were observed what how the bees are doing during the eclipse. But I didn't find so much information about what about their sound, you know, like what happens to their buzz? I mean, are they buzzing the same level that they are doing the daytime, or are they going to night shift? So they start buzzing around, or what about homing? I mean, are the bees coming back to home? Basically, they're hive, they stop foraging at that time. So how are these things that affected? So we ended up like behavioral biologist at our university, Dr. Maria Hopkins. So Professor Hopkins is, she's working on behavioral biology for so long. And I discussed with her what we can do. And she came up with the idea of acoustic devices. So we can record the acoustics of the bees at very low frequency, and we can, or amplification. So we can find out, we can identify the bee buzz clear from the other sounds. So we established those devices in the annual eclipse, which was in October. And then we also set up our cameras for three hives in our campus. And then we observed the bees also by ourselves during the annual eclipse. And we have seen some significant differences. We have seen like a good number of bees were returning to their hives. But again, we did not count them yet. So we are still working on the data analysis because it's like several gigabytes of data that we need to analyze. Computers are helping us, but again, it's not very easy. We need to establish a baseline, and then we need to identify the time. So we are still working on it. But meanwhile, the total eclipse is just coming next Monday. Actually, it will be around this time next week. So we'll be in the apiary, in the VTB hive. So this week, we just established our acoustic devices again to get the baseline for the spring buzz. And then next Saturday or Sunday, we will establish our acoustic device again to have how the bees are acting during the eclipse. So how their sound levels are changing, and also how their activity in front of the hive will be changing. So we are both recording them visually, and also we are recording their audio-visual recording. We are doing both of them. So acoustically and visually, we are recording the honeybees during the eclipse time, and we will compare with the non-eclipse days to see how much the bees' behavior is changing during the eclipse. So this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and we are taking advantage of it to the best extent in terms of analyzing the bees.
That sounds like a lot of fun. So I know you mentioned you have some, you're checking sound, you have some visual things that you're doing, yeah, and observing, just observational. Do you know roughly off the top of your head how many data points or things that you're collecting during the event?
I mean, we're going to collect a lot because we have two acoustic devices per hive. So one of them we are putting at the entrance of the hive, and the other one we are placing about a feet away from the hive because we also would like to catch the bees which are coming to the hive. And then we also have hive in Uvalde, which is on the totality of the path as well. So we have three hives around that area. One of our students has volunteered to bring the acoustic devices there. So we will be having like nine devices of data, that's one. And then also we'll have at least three cameras will be set up to record the entrances and around the hive. And also, and the other beekeepers, they will record with their cell phones and share the data with us. So we have so many data points. I mean, at least nine data points from acoustics, and then at least three data points from the visual.
Okay, that's exciting. Okay, well, you know, when I was thinking about this, you know, I started after we first kind of had our initial discussion, I was kind of going through things in my mind, and I thought, how is a honeybee going to react? And the first thing I thought of is if you think about typically those summer days where it's a nice sunny day, everything seems to be going pretty normally, and then all of a sudden there's a pop-up thunderstorm that shows up, and it gets really dark really fast. You get a big thunderstorm, and then 10 or 15 minutes later, it's over. These were common when I was stationed in Georgia years ago. We'd have these, you know, about 4:45 or 5 p.m. every day. Storm shows up. It's really dark. Lots of lightning and thunder. 15 minutes later, it's sunny like it was before. So in my mind, I thought, well, maybe the bees, they're out and about, they're foraging, and they see this darkness approaching, and they think, uh-oh, maybe it's a storm. I need to hunker down. Or do they not even have the enough intelligence or inherent kind of just knowledge to say, I better just head home as quick as I can. You know, I'm curious to know just what how they react to that and what their first is the instinct to run home real quick, or is it to hunker down?
I mean, yeah, there are a couple of things here. As you know, I mean, these are very interesting and very intelligent animals. So they're out there for 12 million years. So they outnumber almost like so many different species on Earth, like even the dinosaurs. So they were out there for a very long time. So they know what's going on with the weather. They know what's going on, you know, with the wind, you know, the conditions. So the best thing about the bees is, I mean, they are learning, or they are finding their way with the sun's polarity. So they've not used sunlight directly, they use the polar sunlight. So even if it's cloudy, or, you know, like the sun is not available all the way, like it's not a clear sky, bees still can find their way. So they use the sun polarity to find their homes. They also use gravity. Again, I'm not an expert on all of these, so... If the experts listen, they can correct me. But they also use the gravity, and then like their gyroscope they have, so they can also find their homes from the magnetic force on the Earth. And the other thing is that, again, bees are kind of lose their way if they fly over the big, large water bodies. Like, for example, if they fly over a river, or if they fly over a lake, which is not a very active one, so they will fall because of the reflection of the sunlight. So they're going to confuse the polarity of the sunlight and the reflection of the sunlight. So, or even if the bees fly on a glass or on a mirror, again, they will just fall because they cannot differentiate at that point when they're distracted like this. So in terms of eclipse, so the bees realize that it is coming because it's getting darker and darker. And then sun is completely blocked, so even those polar lights will not be able to pass. So, and then, as you know, bees can go up to 5 miles away for foraging, but their safe area is 1.8 to 2 miles. So they can go, like, up to, in terms of kilometers, like, they can go 2.5 to 3 kilometers away from their hive. So it is their safe foraging distance, and they can come back by evening. But again, most of the bees, when they leave in the morning, they don't come until evening, so they can complete their work throughout the whole day. So again, when there's an eclipse in the middle of the day, probably if they are close enough, they will just come back to the hive. So they will kind of suppress their work. They're going to go to the night shift. And then in one study, they said that they decreased their activities up to 80%. And then another one is if they are far, so they will just take a rest on one of the flowers, or they can rest a little bit, and then they will just continue their foraging as the eclipse has gone. So probably they will think that, oh, it's night already, I should take a sleep here, I'm too far from my home. So I think that's what they will do. But yes, these are very smart animals, I mean, and their super body or their super organism is like taking care of so many different things.
Sure. You know, and one thing that I didn't think of, and you may know this, but they may also have the ability, like a lot of animals and insects do, to sense kind of barometric pressure. So they may know, well, this isn't a change in pressure, so it shouldn't be a storm coming through, something like that.
Yeah, that's also true. Yes, they can feel the winds and they can feel the air pressure. You're right.
Okay, well, that's super exciting. So I'm definitely looking forward to hearing how everything goes with that and seeing some of the... Yeah. The results. Now, shifting gears just a bit here, I know that you have a program down there at UT San Antonio. I listened to an episode of your recent podcast, and you talked about the honey pathway. Now, we have a lot of listeners who are in Texas. We've been working with a couple different types of folks in academia through other places throughout the U.S. and in Virginia primarily, who are doing different types of, you know, programs and research and things. So I think that, you know, obviously the more information we share, that the better it is for everyone. Would you mind, you know, taking a few minutes and tell us a little bit about that program so that, you know, other folks might be able to emulate that or at least learn more in case they, as a student, may want to participate?
Yeah, that will be great. This is a very exciting project that we're in right now. So, I mean, we were so lucky and we were so privileged to get awarded from the USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture, the NIFA program. So they have recently established a program called Next Gen. So basically they would like to raise the workforce, diverse workforce for the future of the agriculture. So, and then we applied the Next Gen program back in 2020. And then, so then we were awarded for $2.9 million for 5 years. So, and basically our purpose is, so we will raise awareness about urban beekeeping to our undergraduate students, both in UTSA and St. Philip's College, and as well as we will be, you know, educating our students about medicinal honey. So, so under this program, we have a couple of activities. So the basic one is honey seminars. So it's open to public. It's open to our students. So people can come, and we have speakers every week, either on Zoom or either in person at UTSA. So we invite beekeepers, we invite entrepreneurs, we invite you know, medical doctors also, and then they talk about, you know, different perspectives about the bee biology, pesticides, I mean, the bee diseases, and as well as like how to make a wound aid, like wound management device by using honey, and as well as how to do a podcast. I mean, we have a speaker like that. And then, but also how to make egg valuation in Texas and how the students can earn more money out of honey or honey production. So students learn about these different subjects from very well experienced speakers. So, and then this is our Honey Pet Honey Seminar series. And then we have this our Q program, which is called the Course-Based Undergraduate Research Experience. So this this program is open for our sophomores, juniors, and seniors. So this is a two-semester class. So basically, students are learning how to be a scientist in a year by going through, like, writing a grant and writing a research proposal, and as well as writing, you know, a research paper. So they learn how to read a paper, how to design an experiment, and most of it relates with honey in this case, and also how to collect the data, analyze the data, or how to troubleshoot the data problems with the experiment. And then they also present this data on the CURE symposium. So maybe I should also, for the listeners in San Antonio or vicinity, we will have our students, like more than 16 different projects, will be presented at the CURE symposium about honey pathway on April 26th, Friday. So it will be at the UTSA campus. It's the Sloan building. And we are expecting, I mean, several students and a big audience. So our students will talk about what they have achieved through this CURE program under the honey, with the honey pathway. So another program is our students are encouraged to do research out of the class as well. So there's, it's called Summer Undergraduate Research Experience, the CURE program. So students can do research with other faculty members at UTSA from different departments, like from physics, from geology, from microbiology. So they can do research with other faculty members, and then we fund them, like we provide the stipend for them. And also we have the internship programs, which is mostly focusing on our honey class alumni, like the students who completed the honey CURE class. They are eligible to go for internships at USDA Bee Research Lab. One of our partners, actually, Mike Finstrom there. So he's a great partner, and other people at the UTSA Bee Research Lab in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Another partner of us is Julian Rangel at the Texas A&M Bee Research Lab in College Station. Another partner is like Robin Underwood at Penn State Extension. And then also we have other partners at different parts of the country. And then students, our students are eligible to go to an internship with them. And again, we provide their transportation, logistics, their accommodation, and also a stipend for them, up to $5,000 for their 10-week program. So, and then we also have one important thing, which is the train the trainer. So basically, we will be recruiting high school students. And again, the application is still open. So high school teachers who are in the STEM field, so they can apply for this one, and they will be educated how to scale this honey pathway in their high schools. So they can educate them about beekeeping, about medicinal honey. So they will learn how to analyze the honey. They will learn the basics of beekeeping, and they will be also develop a curriculum together so that this honey pathway can be implemented in the high school settings. So again, we have several different opportunities for the students and as well as high school teachers. And again, this train the trainer program, or it's also called mini CURE program. So this one is eligible up to $10,000 stipend for the high school teachers when they join this 10-week program, which is starting late May until August. So, and so these are the programs under the Honey Pathway. So by the way, Honey Pathway stands for, honey is an acronym for honeybee-oriented next-generation entrepreneurs and youth. So if you get the first name, first letters, it's called Honey. So that's how Honey Pathway is established, and that's what the purpose and the activities on the Honey Pathway.
Yeah, that sounds like a really comprehensive framework. I mean, this seems like the kind of thing to me that if other schools and institutions, I think about, you know, Virginia Tech, I've had some dialogue with some of the folks out there over the past couple of years. It, you know, having schools and major universities like that, they could get into that and have some cooperation and some collaboration and being able to do similar things. I mean, you have everything covered. I mean, I'm making notes as you're talking, and I'm just thinking to myself, like, I don't even know what you could possibly add. You know, what more could you do? You mentioned the, you know, the urban beekeeping component of that. I think we had a gentleman on the podcast about a year or so ago from Detroit, and he's part of a group called Bees in the D, being like downtown Detroit. And they do urban beekeeping, you know, all over the city. He happens to be an elementary school teacher. Right. So as you're talking, I'm thinking, like, geez, I got to get a hold of Brian and let him know about this, because, you know, he's a huge bee advocate for folks in Michigan and throughout North Dakota and other places in the Midwest. And, you know, another thing, though, and this might be something to maybe even take offline, but I would love to get any information that you have, because we do run a Discord room for the podcast. And I'd love to take all the information that you have around any of the programs and incorporate that into an area of the Discord, so people can have access to that information. I think that would be amazing.
Sure. I'll be happy to share that. So I just forgot to add one thing on the Honey Pathway. I'm sorry. Okay. So we talk about beekeeping, but how do we educate our students for beekeeping? That's the part I skipped. So we also have apprenticeship program. So our Be Mindful, the Natalie Bigger-Misery, she's our master beekeeper. So from the Be Mindful in Austin, Texas, and she's also my master beekeeper. That's how I learned beekeeping from her out of her one-year program. So David and the Les Crowder, so which is the father of top-art beekeeping. So Natalie and Les will join us, and then they will educate 10 of our students with an 80-hour program of apprenticeship. So they're going to do one in May for 40 hours and another one in October, another 40 hours. So in both of them, students will learn the basics of beekeeping, as well as like the extensive learning. And then they will also learn about like in-class teaching. There's also lots of hands-on activities. So they will learn how to do splitting, or they will learn how to, you know, analyze the, like do the, how to identify different bees, like drones and workers and the queen. And as well as they will be experienced with different type of honeys. Like we'll have top-bar honey, top-bar hives, we'll have lang hives, we'll have probably have a flow hive, we're going to work on an apimaya hive, as well as barrel hive. So we're going to have different type of hives in our apiary, so the students can get exposed to different beekeeping styles. And then they will be ready for beekeeping for future. And another our future project is that we are still working on. We'd like to put beehives with the city of San Antonio to the parks and recreation area. So our students who are educated in the apprenticeship program, so they can be the beekeepers for the city of San Antonio to take care of them. And also our students will be getting the apprentice level certificate from the Texas Beekeeping Master Beekeeper Program. So they will take the test and they will become apprentice level beekeepers. So hopefully by at the end of 5 years of the program, we will introduce at least 40 to 50 beekeepers into the San Antonio beekeeping industry, I would say, or like beekeeping field. So that's one of our programs that we are also under the Honey Pathway. So I know you had a different question, but I just answered this one.
No, that's great. Honestly, I'm sitting here thinking to myself about how jealous I am of all the exciting things you have going on down there, because I want to play too. Well, I tell you, I mean, I'm kind of almost speechless at all the activity that you have going on and all the upcoming plans and the things you have in place already. Like I said, I think a lot of different universities and educational, you know, groups could, you know, even if it's just a bee club, I think they can still model, you know, some of the things that you're doing, you know, to kind of help educate and teach, and super exciting. Well,
cooperate with anybody who would like to, like, need any help with implementing the Honey Pathway into their own program. I'll be happy to share our curriculum. I'll be happy to share our plans for the apprenticeship. or plans for our cure classes. So if they would like to implement, and again, I'll be happy to share our best practices because we are still developing those classes. So again, we'll be so happy to collaborate with other universities for the Honey Pathway.
No, that's great. That's very generous, and I'm sure somebody will probably reach out to you and take you up on that offer. Well, well, Dr. Ozturk, I tell you, I sincerely appreciate you taking the time to chat with us today. I would ask you, you know, please keep us updated on any developments you have in research or anything. If you ever say, man, we got to get this information out to people and you want to come back again anytime, you're always welcome. You know, give me a call and we'll bring you back on the podcast again to talk about honey or bees or whatever you have going on down there. And we definitely are interested in hearing more about any post-eclipse reports you might have. And of course, if you need a hand, don't hesitate. I'm here for you. I'm always happy to come down and lend you a hand. Outside of that, I think we'll go ahead and wrap it up for the day. Did you have any last-minute comments or anything else you wanted to share with the folks?
Yes. Anybody who's interested in Honey Pathway, they can follow us from our Instagram pages. It is UTSA Honey Pathway. And they can also visit our website. They can basically Google Honey Pathway UTSA, and it will bring them to the sciences.utsa.edu/student-programs/honey. So they will be able to get more information. Again, we will publish or we will update most of our information on these venues. And again, Instagram will be our best connection. And I also would like to mention another good thing that happened out of Honey Pathway. So my students who are graduates last year and from my class, they established a club which is called Honeycomb Connection. So Honeycomb Connection is a student organization established at the UTSA this semester actually. And they have been nominated for the most promising student organization in the UTSA. So they have been lots of activities. They are inviting so many speakers. They are educating the people about beekeeping, the students. So they are very active, like they are busy like the bees. So, and they have lots of activities all in their work. So, yeah.
No, that's great. That's great. Well, what I'll do, I'll plan on probably following up with maybe Ari or John, whoever's most appropriate, to make sure we get all those links, and we'll definitely stay in touch to make sure that all that information can get posted on our Discord. And like I said, if you have research students or anybody that has a requirement that they need to discuss things with a public entity of some sort and they'd like to come on the podcast, we're happy to support you folks any way we can here, and we'll definitely get the information up on the Discord as well. And that being said, again, thank you so much, Dr. Ozturk, for your time. We definitely appreciate it, and we'll look forward to talking to you again in the future.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Take care. Well, I hope you folks enjoyed the interview with Dr. Ozturk as much as I did. I am absolutely baffled and amazed at how much he and the team down there at UT are doing around beekeeping, honey, research, education. It was just a really, really good time. Really enjoyed the opportunity. So hopefully we will get him to come back and chat with us again and share the results of his eclipse research and any other exciting things that he and the team down there want to share. We are going to be posting a lot of the information that we discussed in the Discord room. If you're a person who's not on Discord and you want the info, you just don't feel like signing up for something else, I get it. Just drop me an email and I will send that over to you directly once I have that over from his team. So again, thank you so much for taking the time to listen today. I appreciate it. You folks take care and we will talk to you soon. So long.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.